welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I am David Bax.
I didn't like that, and thank you for listening, David.
Yes.
How you doing?
The listeners might know the last time we'd recorded with you, we're not using our up-to-date board, right. We're using the old board.
Yeah.
There were some problems, so kind of the reason I introduced myself very staccato like that was because I was looking at the levels sure I was registering as I was saying that.
Yeah.
So, looks good for now. I'll just have to keep an eye on it. I also have to make sure not to flail about, which I never realized before Natalie made me very aware of it, but I do talk with my hands.
Yeah.
I never thought of myself as a guy who, like, gesticulates, but I really talk with my hands.
I also talk with my hands, which I did not realize until I had no access to my hands.
Right, yeah.
It's very strange. It's very strange when, like, you're just instinctively, like, whether it be like air quotes or just certain gestures that you make without even realizing it, and then suddenly you're very aware that you're of what you do naturally.
But the reason I mentioned Natalie is because she has said when we go out to dinner with another couple and we're sitting on the same side of the table, she'll say beforehand, like, don't hit me in the face. You have almost hit me in the face too many times.
Oh my gosh.
I was just like getting too into a conversation. Yeah. And like, I've never actually hit her in the face, but she's like, I'm afraid you're going to hit me in the face one of these days. Cause I get animated. Have I told you, I don't even know if I've told you this, almost certainly haven't told the listeners this yet. So, Natalie knew who I was before we met.
Okay.
Because she knew me as a guy who would hold court in the line for Comedy Death Ray on Tuesdays outside the UCB. I don't think of myself...
So knowing that about you, she still was okay with, talking to you at all?
I don't think of myself as... Yeah, she didn't like me at first.
Oh, okay.
When she didn't know me.
Sure.
When we actually, met in person, obviously I'm a charm machine,
Absolutely.
I don't think of myself as a court holder generally, but I guess in that situation I would have been with my friends. I would have been so in my element and so comfortable that I guess I can see myself, I don't know, holding court in her terms.
Now I've had people have said the same thing about me, and of course you don't realize it in the moment, but you also realize and it's not even so much about you monopolize the conversation. It's not even that. It's more just you drive the conversation, which, given that you and I have been doing this for so long, it's really not that surprising. I feel like just in one of the impacts that the podcast has had on me is that I'm able to hold a conversation with multiple people with pretty much no pauses at all. I can immediately jump from this person to that person, ask for clarification, all that kind of thing, and then maybe offer my own commentary, but for the most part I wind up asking a lot of questions.
Oh, it's like the McLaughlin group or whatever.
Exactly. Wrong. I say wrong. I can see that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's, I feel like that's not the term I would use.
Holding court?
Yeah, because that definitely feels
annoying.
Oh, absolutely.
I mentioned Comedy Death Ray. You and I are big comedy fans. That for a long time was a big part of this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Less so as years have gone on. But the comedy community and the art of comedy lost a major figure within this past week or so, Paul Rubens.
It was, this is just something that happens, is there are certain entertainers that, or just public figures that will pass away, and you're just wait, I thought death didn't apply to you. You know, it's just hard to explain.
David Bowie is the one that I didn't think that David Bowie could die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's you are one of the only things that is everlasting, right?
Yeah.
And honestly, there's something about comedy that it's even if the person jokes about serious stuff, it just doesn't feel like death is just in the cards. That's how I felt about Norm Macdonald. It's what? What?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense. And Paul Rubens, I think because all of us think of him as Pee Wee Herman, who's kind of this man-child, so, like, the idea of aging didn't apply to him, so why would death? And, when he passed away, I just thought, like, wow. And along those lines, like, another one like that is, like, Weird Al. Like, I cannot imagine
him someday
passing away, but he will someday. Yeah. And, but one of the things that I was thinking is, like, obviously everybody knows him first and foremost as Pee Wee Herman, but, you know, and he's done a lot of other fun stuff, too, like in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, in the show Gotham, where they brought him back to play Penguin's dad,
isn't that fun? That's so cool.
Yeah. And then Mystery Men, and, you know, and he had I remember when I was younger, he showed up on Murphy Brown for a few episodes, and he was very memorable. But one of the things that I wanted to ask, and obviously we could take longer to dissect this, and I'm not asking this in an incredulous way at all. It's more just the kind of thing where it's like, why was Pee Wee Herman funny? I'm not saying he wasn't. I thought he was. But I have a hard time placing exactly why.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he was kind of doing... He was couching the, I guess, absurd in something that was a recognizable format.
Yeah.
And so I guess there was something in that that... what's the word I'm looking for? That tension between like what he's doing is anarchic, but what he's doing is in the framework in which it's happening would seem to be this very like safe.
Yeah, that's true.
But I don't know. I mean, you know, I like to analyze comedy. I know a lot of people don't like when people analyze comedy. I do like to analyze comedy, but he's just sometimes it's just funny, you know?
I know. And it's this is how I feel about like Ed Grimley, and even something like Wayne and Garth, where it's just like, I mean, these are developed characters who just are just funny, but I can't even really put my finger on what's funny about them. It's like, well, I guess they say funny things, but it's more than that.
Yeah.
And, Pee Wee Herman was definitely one of those, a truly original creation. And, and also, speaking of Norm MacDonald, Paul Rubens passed away of cancer that he didn't tell anybody about. And, you know, on one hand, that's kind of a bummer because it kind of gives, if you know that someone is sick, it gives people a chance to, like, really treasure the person while they're still here. But I also get it, which is like Norm MacDonald. I remember I saw an interview with Anthony Jeselnik where he was on Howie Mandel's show at the exact moment that like word got out about Norm, and they were just like shocked. And Anthony Jeselnik, who had worked with Norm on Last Comic Standing, he had said, like, he goes, oh, I wish I'd been nicer to him. And I think that is the exact attitude that, like, Paul Rubens or Norm MacDonald wanted to avoid. It's like, I don't want you to associate me at all with pity or anything like that.
Sure.
I want you to associate me with funny until the moment I don't exist anymore. And I kind of respect that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, Paul Rubens, RIP.
Yeah.
He was... tremendously, it was definitely one of a kind.
Yeah, I'm so glad that I guess now we're a ways removed from the height of the pandemic. When I say the pandemic, I mean the time when we weren't going out at all.
Right.
I rewatched Pee-wee's Big Adventure for the first time in forever in 2020 or maybe early 2021.
Yeah.
And it was even funnier than I remember, and it was greater. And it's not just Pee-wee the character, he also wrote the movie with Phil Hartman, so a lot of the stuff that isn't even him is funny. I've told you, I don't know, I'll cut this out if you don't want me to talk about this, but because, as you said, you can't move, you know?
Yeah.
So if you need something, you ask for it, and you always say please at the end, which is very nice, but I'm always reminded of Pee-wee offering Francis the trick gum and asking if he wants mint or fruit, and Francis saying, fruit, please.
Yeah, and you know what? I didn't watch the Netflix Pee-wee thing that our friend Paul Rust helped write. I haven't watched it. I feel like I should, though.
Yeah, I probably should. Well, before we move on, I want to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. Speaking of people who passed away, I mean, yes, Robbie Robertson passed away, so RIP Robbie Robertson, but also Rodriguez, Sixto Rodriguez, just known as Rodriguez, the subject of the Oscar-winning documentary Searching for Sugar Man.
Oh, yeah.
He also just died at the age of 81, and this morning on my morning walk, I was revisiting some of his best songs, and they sounded great in my TweakedAudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low price at TweakedAudio.com, but if you use the offer code PRETENTION at checkout, you get one-third off that already low price. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code PRETENTION.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Tyler?
Yeah.
I'm realizing that, like, doing the podcast standing up, which I am because I'm, like, literally at your bedside, throws me off. I am not used to, like, I keep forgetting the cadences and stuff like that.
Well, it's like a standing desk, you know?
People say that's like, better. Like Rumsfeld.
Exactly. What was it? There was an episode of Family Guy where Peter was, like, working for his father-in-law's company, and then his father-in-law, like, had something over on him. Or maybe it was just that, like, he was doing him a favor by employing him. And he's like, he says, like, this is what you have to do while you work for me. And one of them is, you have to use a standing desk. And it's like, all right, he goes, but you also have to tell everyone all the time about how superior it is. And you have to say frequently, sitting is the real killer.
Yeah.
And Peter's like, can I just let people live their lives? He's like, no. Yeah. And so that's what I associate with a standing desk.
Yeah. I think I said this on the podcast before, but like, you know, most of my coworkers like me are pretty liberal. So whenever they have a standing desk, I'm like, oh, you're just like Donald Rumsfeld. Okay.
There you go.
Now we're, a little over a month ago, Scott, Nye and I, counted down our top five films of 2023 so far. You understandably have taken a little bit of time to get up. Haven't been able to make it out to the theaters, so you're kind of waiting for things to show up on streaming or however you're watching them. So a little bit late, we are going to do your top five films of the year so far. Did you want me? I know you said you wanted me to recap my top five. Were you saying at the end or now?
Now.
Okay. So my top five of the year at the time. Has since changed. Number five, You Hurt My Feelings. Number four, Asteroid City. Number three, Infinity Pool. Number two, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. And number one, Past Lives.
Okay. So, yeah, we do have some overlap here.
Okay.
And so I'll say this. The big... When I say big, I mean big for us. The big movies that I haven't seen Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, which I've heard nothing but great things about. I have not seen You Hurt My Feelings, which based on my adoration of Enough Said, I think I would love.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Barbie and Oppenheimer yet, obviously, because they're pretty recent. I haven't seen the new Mission Impossible. And as of today, the Last Voyage of the Demeter is in theaters, and I've been looking forward to that movie for months. And, you know, I'm obviously not going to see it for a while, but I'm glad that it's getting good reviews, because the first thing I thought was like, damn, that is an amazing premise. Like, everyone knows that aspect of Dracula, that when he goes from Transylvania to London, the ship arrives with nobody left alive, and they never go into any detail about it. And so it's like, oh, let's just hypothesize what that looked like. And I was like, oh my gosh. How has no one thought of that until right now? So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I hope to like it too. When I first, I think I've said, like, we've been doing a podcast for, I don't know, 20 fucking years or something. No, it's been 16. Coming up on 16 and a half if we're still counting half years. So I'm going to repeat myself. But when I, same as you, when I heard the premise, I thought that's terrific, but as I always do, the first thing I looked at is who's the director. I have not been a fan of Andre Overdahl since he came to America. He made
Trollhunter is like his big thing.
Trollhunter was the one that made his name, and it's like, it's not, you know, it's not an amazing movie, but it's a lot of fun. And then he came here and he made Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which I didn't really like. He made a movie called Mortal, which was god-awful, I have to say. I don't know. Some people... I didn't see Autopsy of Jane Doe, which I know people... some people liked. I can't speak to that. So I was a little trepidatious. What's up?
I like Scary Stories more than you do.
Right.
I do think that its problems are with the script. From a tonal standpoint and just the general mood, I think he nails it.
By the way... you and I you might be reading different reviews than the norm. I don't know if you, the current Rotten Tomatoes score for Last Voyage of the Demeter is 45%.
Really? Because I've seen a lot of people on Twitter say good things about it, and I saw the AV Club was very complimentary of it, and I'm just looking at the wrong.
I haven't really read any reviews at all.
The thing that everyone says, and I could see some people saying this as a criticism, that it's basically Alien on board a ship, a sailing ship, and part of me is like, yeah, all right, what's the problem? what point are you making here?
Yeah, that sounds pretty great.
Yeah. So with my, you know what? Did you guys talk about your least favorite movies of the year so far?
We didn't.
Okay, I'm going to.
Yeah, it's your episode. Right, you can do what you want.
Right now, I've got two movies that are in the running for least favorite. One is a movie I've talked about before, Nefarious, which is a Christian horror movie. And we can put quotes around horror because it is not scary. And I think it's not trying to be. It's trying to be a little bit like a psychological thriller, but it does pretty much everything wrong, where it's just like, it's this psychiatrist talking to a prison inmate who claims to be possessed by a demon. So it's the two of them talking for long stretches of time, and it's like, all right, that's not bad. But just like, so many of the artistic choices it makes are just, they're just wrong, which is like, all right, we want these two guys to like be in this battle of wills or whatever. You know what we should do? Put them in the middle of a massive room where there's no sense of claustrophobia at all. And just to really emphasize it, let's do some nice big wide shots. And it's like, what are you doing, man? Like, whatever tension you created, you've completely diffused at this point. And it's written just as Christian movies often are, just really on the nose and that kind of thing.
I haven't seen it, so I don't have anything to say about that, but saying Christian horror reminded me, are you aware of the Instagram account Christian Nightmares?
No.
It's basically Christian people doing things that are unintentionally hilarious.
Oh boy.
Like, here's a...
Well, it happens a lot.
Here's a sign. It's a sign outside a church that says, "Eat the devil's corn, you will choke on his cob."
But that has to be on purpose. It has to be, right?
And then here's one that I don't even know how to describe. I don't entirely understand what it's supposed to be. It says it's faith as small as a mustard seed. So it's a mustard seed, but it looks like it's in an anus.
Well, I mean, like, is or like a peach or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I guess I don't know, like,
what a mustard seed looks
exactly.
like.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, Christian Nightmares is
well, obviously, I'm going to subscribe to that as soon as I can.
Yeah.
So the other least, oh, what do we got?
Okay, let just the see. Rule of threes, I'll do a third one.
Oh, no. No, no.
It says, come, Holy Spirit, come, and it has a likeness of what I think is supposed to be a tree, but it looks like a phallus
yes.
instead of leaves just squirting yeah. everywhere.
Yeah, boy. This is the thing, is like, it's something that, that my friends and I have talked about. I believe one time we were doing this riff, but you ever mentioned the Kendrick brothers, right?
Yeah.
So, we were on this riff about someone getting tattoos of Kendrick brother movie titles on genitals and on your butt. And so it was just like, and I don't remember, it was like Facing the Giants would be like on your balls or whatever. And so, and then your butt, it would be War Room.
Uh-huh.
And then we were kind of going and I was like, oh my gosh. He's like, he goes, what would we have tattooed on our dick? And I'm like, they literally have a movie called Overcomer. And it's like, and he goes, yeah. How did they not realize? I'm like, because they're just shut off from
yeah.
anything that could be considered lewd. And so maybe their audience doesn't realize it either, yeah. But man, oh man. Anyway, okay, so the okay. other movie yeah, that I really didn't hate. Like, The Little Mermaid.
Ah.
What? So I'm on record as hating these live action remakes anyway. I like Cinderella. Aladdin actually wasn't that bad. I abhor The Lion King. And Little Mermaid is not far behind. It's just such a, it's so unnecessary. It's such a waste of time and resources. Anything new that it adds to the story, only it serves to like slow it down, or it doesn't fit tonally with what they're doing at all. And the thing that I was thinking about is just like when you look at the original Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin, whatever, is it like there's just a charm to them that these movies don't have because the movies are trying to be grounded in reality. And when you do that, it's like, yeah, but we all live in reality and it's not that interesting, you know? Like, Melissa McCarthy plays Ursula and she's good. She does a good job. It's fine. But when it comes right down to it, they're trying to make this as realistic as this octopus woman can be, as opposed to like the animated Ursula, where like just her face is so big and just completely disproportionate. Like she doesn't look like an actual person.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, you, as it turns out, you can do more when you're not trying to evoke reality. And yeah, so it's just such a swing and a miss. And it's just so frustrating. Like, I know this is something that like critics say all the time. It's like, how many solid mid-budget or low-budget movies with, you know, an ounce of originality could have been made for the budget for that one movie that did not do well at the box office anyway. And yeah, it was just so frustrating as I was watching it, because it's just, again, it's, I feel like it's pure studio calculation. I think it's them like, how can we wring more money out of this concept? I don't think there's any artistic elements behind it. I don't think anybody actually cares about it as an artistic product. And, yeah, it just really, really depressed me.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, sorry, guys. excuse me. So getting in my top five, I'll try to go through them relatively quickly because we got a late start.
It's okay.
Number five is Brandon Cronenberg's Infinity Pool.
I'm so glad that you liked it.
Boy, oh boy, I really liked it. And yeah, of course, like, there is some very strange moments and strange scenes and that kind of thing. But, you know, going back to what I was saying about, like, original ideas. Granted, there are elements in the film that have been used elsewhere. But what I like about it, so I'm sure David already talked about the story. It's this couple at a nice resort, and they go out joyriding with another couple, and they wind up accidentally hitting and killing a local with their car, and the local government requires that they get the death penalty. But they also say, oh, well, if you want, like, we can actually make a double of you, and he can pay the consequences for a price, and then you can just go about your lives. So he does that, and then he falls into this small society of people that have done this, and as a result, and they just live this completely hedonistic, horrible lifestyle. And one thing that I love is that, like, the concept of, you know, oh, the double has the character's memories and all that kind of thing. And so, you know, so many other sci-fi movies have said, like, oh, but which one's the double? And what I like is that question is addressed in a party atmosphere, and it's immediately laughed off. Uh-huh. I kind of love that there's, like, oh, yeah, we don't have time for that. We're too busy drinking.
Yeah.
But what I love about it, and maybe this is just the Christian in me, the idea of somebody paying the price for what you did. But in this case, it's just you again. Like, it's just so fascinating to me because ultimately by having their clones or doubles pay the price, these characters live in a world completely free of consequence, at least to them. But in order to do that, they have to numb themselves to the idea mm-hmm. of these doubles, which by all accounts are just other people with a genuine amount of fear going in. They have to just make peace with the fact that, like, oh yeah, that's gonna happen. And so it's this idea that, like, every double that dies, it's like another little part of these characters is dying. And so thematically, I remember thinking, like, oh, and I actually said this kind of as a joke on Twitter, but it's not really a joke, that, like, I see it as, like, the White Lotus meeting Lord of the Flies. You know, it's just these people in a remote situation removed from their lives, and what happens when you take away consequences, and it's just, like, they do whatever they want, they become just monstrous people. But that's just the story and the theme. I also just think I love the score. I think it's shot beautifully, and they really create this sense of, like, paradise turning into, like, this horrible purgatory kind of thing. And yeah, I have not seen Possessor. By all accounts, it's just as good, if not better. And I'm certainly going to watch it now. But yeah, I was not. I expected Infinity Pool to be interesting and intriguing. I did not expect it to, like, stick with me like it has been. And I really, really love it.
Yeah. Listeners already heard me talk about it. But, I mean, we're in the age of Mia Goth. Yeah. And she's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, my gosh.
In this movie. Yeah, I think it's the first thing I've seen her in that she's using her actual native accent.
I'm trying to think what else I've seen her in.
Well, she was in X and Pearl last year.
Yeah, and I haven't seen either of those.
Oh, someone's at the door.
I'm recording, no. Ian.
All right. Well, that's staying in, obviously. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember what else, but let's move on.
Okay. Oh, and I will say about Mia Goth, that scene where she's on the hood of the car.
Oh, my God.
Like, mocking our main character.
Yeah.
My thought was, like, I've never wanted a character dead so much. And immediately I was like, yeah, that's probably not going to happen. Damn
it. But, I mean, I get what you mean, because she's being awful, but also like, I love it. It's so fun.
It's a great performance, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so next up for me is a movie that I believe you have not seen, which is fascinating that I've seen it before you.
Okay.
And that's John Wick Chapter 4.
I know. I haven't seen it.
Man, oh man.
What is wrong with me?
So, you know, I've liked the John Wick movies. I caught up on all of them a few months ago. And with the fourth one, I just thought, like, it's going to be just, like, more of the same. And in some ways it is, but it's just... It's one of those things, I've said this before, and I've said it about, like, Mission Impossible movies, that I like when an action movie wrings every little bit of action from every circumstance.
Sure.
And this one, even more than the others, it does that. There was this amazing scene where, there's this amazing sequence where he basically has to get across town, and along the way, the you know, bounty or whatever you want to call it just keeps going up and up. So, like, he just keeps hitting, like, more
assassins?
More assassins, and each section of this sequence is astonishing, and it's unique from the others. Like, there's one that's essentially, I wouldn't say a car chase so much as a gunfight, but everyone's in cars. And it's just so wonderfully done. And there are some moments that have a really good sense of humor to them. There's a couple of fun movie references. There's a very direct Lawrence of Arabia reference. I think that there's a sequence that is paying homage to The Exorcist.
Okay.
And that scene also happens to be hilarious, which I think is on purpose. Not 100% sure.
I think the John Wick movies have become more and more comedic. I mean, in their own way. But I think, like, near the beginning of Chapter 3, when they just, like, find themselves in a room full of knives, and suddenly knives are involved, and then gets slowly stabbed through the eyeball. Like, it's awful. Yeah. It's incredibly violent, but there is a bit of comedy through that, to, like, these guys are chasing me, and, oh, look, there's knives everywhere now.
Yeah. Oh, I think you'll absolutely find these things funny that I thought were funny. But also, they introduce a couple new characters, and that one of them played by Donnie Yen.
Okay.
And he's amazing in it. And his sequence is, he plays a blind assassin. And I remember you and I, when we were talking about Don't Breathe, we said, like, all right, this character's blind. But I think a lot of movies, they're like, oh, look at how amazing these blind characters are. But it's like, yeah, but they still got to do, like, basic things to know where they are and all that. And so there are a couple things in Don't Breathe that you and I liked, because it showed, like, it at least acknowledged that, yeah, there are still some things he has to do. And so Donnie Yen, like, there are moments where, because he has a cane, he has a cane sword, and so, like, as he's like, following people, he'll, like, run the sword across, like, along a wall until it stops, like, and he does it just so swiftly and so fluidly that it's just like, oh man, I totally buy it, and I think it's astonishing. And it really is just and there's also, like, a lot of people, including myself, have said that, like, John Wick after a while feels like a video game. And this movie leans into that very overtly, where there's this one sequence where he's basically, like, going from one weapon to another, increasing in lethality. and then the camera goes from at his angle to like above him, like looking down, straight down.
Wow.
As he goes from room to room and all that. And,
I gotta see this. This sounds so cool.
It is so great. I definitely think it's the best of the four. I think there's tremendous craftsmanship. It's absolutely gorgeous looking.
Yeah.
As they all have been. And you'll love it. You like the other ones.
I mean, you mentioned that idea of trying to get everything out of a scene. Chad Stahelski has made no secret of the fact that he's a big fan of Buster Keaton and other silent comedians, and that feels like something that comes from that. Like, let's see how many things we can do with physically with what's in front of us.
I believe there is even one of the John Wick posters where he has all the guns pointed at him.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's a reference to a Harold Lloyd publicity poster.
But is it two or three where, like, there's Buster Keaton is literally projecting the wall.
I think
two and three kind of run together for me.
Yeah, me too. I don't totally remember, but
so that's your number four. What's number three?
Number three is another overlap with you, Wes Anderson's Asteroid City, a film that I'll be honest, I wanted to like more than I did. I don't think I've truly loved a Wes Anderson film since Fantastic Mr. Fox. Even Grand Budapest, like, there are things that I love about it, but the movie as a whole I didn't necessarily love.
I love Grand Budapest. It makes me sad when the cat dies. Other than that, Grand Budapest is probably my favorite.
Yeah.
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And of course, you know what? I got pretty close to loving The French Dispatch. But I thought, like, not all of the stories were on the same level. Some of them were more interesting than others, as tends to happen with a movie like that.
Yeah.
But Asteroid City is, I mean, unsurprisingly, it's just so beautiful. And it just does such a great job of, like, how do you make a city look both three-dimensional and two-dimensional at the same time? Which, given the, I won't say framing device, because it's obviously more than that, but given the storytelling device, it makes sense why it would have to look like both. But it's not merely like things are really beautiful, but it's also like there's some genuinely funny jokes in there, like a highway ramp that has been abandoned, but not torn down.
Yeah.
And the specifics of, like, the little motel and all that. You really get such a sense of place. More so, maybe, than, like, I mean, yeah, I guess I got that with Grand Budapest, but, and maybe even Darjeeling Limited or Life Aquatic. Like, he's just really good at creating something out of whole cloth and then really exploring it, which I think he does in this movie. And while I had a hard time emotionally connecting with it, that's one of the good things about him, is when you have characters that are speaking in sort of that monotone, then that means every little gesture is huge, you know? Like, this was a film where, like, you know, people are just declaring how they feel, but not having any of the emotion to go with it. And then suddenly somebody holds somebody else's hand, and it's like the biggest thing ever. And I almost started crying as a result. Mm. I'm still fascinated by the way he makes movies. And even if I don't love his movies, I still admire the hell out of them. And that's definitely how I feel about this movie, where there are frequent moments that I think are absolutely wonderful, and then other moments that I think are merely very good. And of course, it's got an amazing cast, and I think he uses them very well. And there's just certain images that I'll always remember, like Liev Schreiber shooting a laser gun during target practice and stuff.
Yeah.
Certainly anything I have to say about the film is not new, but I'm sure everyone else has been saying it. It is a very well-loved movie, and I certainly really liked it as well.
Yeah, I really dug it, and definitely plan to watch it again. My only, like, the stuff that I tend to not like about Wes Anderson is when I feel like he's pushing for sentimentality, because he's not an unsentimental
right.
director, but his way of expressing himself is a little bit, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say it without saying something like offensive, maybe, about people with like a mental illness.
Oh,
but
sure.
Like a lot of the times the stuff in his movies that moves me the most is the things you're talking about that are so small, you know? Asteroid City definitely maybe loses half a star or so on Letterboxd for things like the Margot Robbie scene, which I thought was like really pushing for something that I, as opposed to like arriving somewhere.
I like that scene a lot, because I feel like it didn't push that. It didn't push too hard. It definitely was a lot more overt than his other scenes, which is really saying something considering how overt his scenes are, at least as far as the dialogue. But that scene really worked for me.
Okay. But the reason I intend to return to Asteroid City, the movie and the place, is that, I mean, sadness and melancholy have always been a part of his movies.
Yeah.
There's an argument to be made, I think, that Asteroid City is the saddest movie that he's made. And I think it's because it's about people who come face to face with something ineffable and something like that is glorious. And it just the knowledge that there's so much more out there just makes them sadder.
Yeah.
I found that very moving.
Yeah.
Are we on to number two for you? Yeah.
Much to my surprise, and I don't know, I actually don't know if you've seen this or not, but when I saw it, boy, it really hooked me and it really got me, and that's M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin.
That's another one I missed a lot early in this year. So, I really want to see that because I liked Old a lot.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet.
So I was definitely looking forward to this. And I love Dave Bautista. So, yeah, I was looking forward to this.
Man, it's good on a lot of levels. But Dave Bautista is the heart of that movie, and his performance, it's heartbreaking, it's frightening, it's sympathetic, it's endearing, it's all of these things, and he pulls it off so wonderfully, and it's just, and it works so well with his frame. Like, the choice to cast him itself is tremendously inspired. The rest of the cast is great, too, but, like, his character is written well, and he is doing something very special, which is really exciting. One of the things that I, as the case with every Shyamalan movie, even the ones that aren't that good, is that, like, he has such a command of tone that there are scenes, like, you know, I'm not going to be spoiling anything when I say that the four people that come to the cabin, they make it very clear they are not going to hurt anybody.
Okay.
Like, they say that from the outset. And yet, we don't believe them. Even when it's clear, when it is made clear they are not going to hurt anybody, there's still this tension of, like, well, whether you hurt us or not, this situation is just so horrifying that, like, the fact that you're, even just the fact that you're here is itself threatening. And that's in the writing, in the performances, but also in just the general tone. That is really hard to pull off. Like, that absolutely could have, like, took the air out of whatever sense of suspense there was, but it never lets up. You're always there, just, and you're so curious. Every development, you're just like, man, where are we going with this, and how is this going to end, and what's true and what isn't, and it's just, and it's one of those things where, like, after a certain point, you kind of want to believe this thing, but you also don't, because to do so is terrible. And so it's just this wonderful little, you know, twilight zone of a movie that that worked for me on basically every level. And I think you would adore it.
Two things. Dave Bautista's got to be the most talented pro wrestler turned actor, right?
I remember you and I, I had this thought. You and I were talking about this with Mike Schmidt, and on that episode where he and I talked about wrestling for the whole episode.
Yeah.
but most talented.
I mean, obviously The Rock has the Rock screen presence to burn.
Like, absolutely.
That's great. And but I mean, so does Dave Bautista. Who's like John Cena has obviously carved out a great role as a comic actor.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think who else, like Jesse Ventura was in some things, right? Yeah. Piper.
Who else?
Hulk Hogan obviously is not a good actor. Kevin Nash has shown up, like he's in the first John Wick, and he was on an episode of Detroiters. Did you watch Detroiters?
No, I didn't.
Oh, well, you'd love it. You're a Tim Robinson fan. So he he plays Tim Robinson's dad in an episode of Detroiters.
And was he also in the first Magic Mike?
Oh, I think he was. I think he was. Yeah. So yeah, he's good, but I don't know. I mean, Dave Bautista is just...
No, I think I agree with you. Like, when I think of whether it be like Blade Runner or certain beats in Guardians and certainly this movie... I think Dave Bautista like has a great deal of charisma, but it's the kind of charisma that can be molded and shaped into something else. Whereas I think The Rock, as much as I enjoy him, and I do, I always enjoy him, I feel like he's just so damn charming and so and has so much of a specific kind of movie star big screen charisma that, yeah, I think there are things that Bautista has done that Dwayne Johnson actually probably would not be able to do. Mm-hmm. I don't think he would be able to shed who he is.
Right.
So yeah, I think I'm inclined to agree with you. As much as I love Randy Savage as a Bonesaw.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I changed my mind.
Yeah.
No. And then my other thing I was going to say. This is. I don't know if this was intentional or just. But the nature of how you're able to watch things, even though we're doing this in August, all your picks are from the first half of the, like all things that were released by the end of June, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Yes.
Okay. I don't know if you intended to do that or if it was just like,
well, it's just
nothing that was released in July is available to you yet.
Yeah. I think it's just the nature of that.
Yeah.
I did recently a few days ago, I watched, Across the Spider-Verse. I don't remember when that was released.
That was in June.
Okay.
That might have even been the end of May when that came out.
Okay.
I know that I was on the East Coast with Natalie, and then I got sick, not COVID, got sick after that trip, which is why I didn't get a chance to see it before we did before Scott and I did our episode. Okay, so we're on to your number one, right?
Number one. Number one is... another movie that I think you missed, which was is Ari Aster's Bo is Afraid.
I haven't seen it, but I'm so glad
it's
on your list, because some people hate it.
Yeah, and you know what? There are times when someone will be like, most people hate it, or some people hate it. And I will immediately respond with like, yeah, but they're stupid. I can't say that this time. I totally get why someone wouldn't like it. It's a very, very stressful movie, as it should be. It is not necessarily visually, but it is inherently expressionistic.
Okay.
In that we're dealing with an anxiety-ridden character. And, you know, as someone who, I don't struggle with anxiety, but I struggle with depression, and any kind of mental illness is going to color the way you see the world to such a degree that the world might as well be that. So we have a character that is just riddled with anxiety, and so we see the world through his eyes. And at first you think, like, is this some kind of, like, dystopian future movie or, like, some kind of alternate reality? And it's like, well, yes, to the alternate reality mm-hmm. thing, but not insofar as, like, a parallel reality. It's more just the reality of this man. Like, it puts you... We're not watching a guy who is anxious. We're seeing the world through his eyes, where he lives in, like, this nightmarish neighborhood in New York, where, like, he winds up accidentally leaving his apartment door unlocked. And, of course, every person in the neighborhood just immediately goes into his apartment, like, goes into his building, goes into his apartment, completely trashes it. And it's just, like, obvious. It's like everyone just seemed to know all at the same time, oh, his apartment's unlocked, let's go. And it's like, yeah, that's how an anxious person, that's how someone would think, which is like the absolute worst thing that could happen, even if it doesn't make a great deal of sense. And so that's on one part, on one half, is just transporting you into the mind of this person who, you know, has trouble processing things the way your average person does. But also, it's so much more than that. It is about his relationships, specifically with his mom, and just because the film starts, this is not a spoiler, the film starts with her dying, and so he has to, like, make his way to her house for the funeral, and along the way, he's processing all kinds of stuff about his childhood, opportunities that he did not get because of his mother, or rather the way he views his mother, and then just the characters that he meets along the way, like, none of the performances are naturalistic. Like, all of them are at least a little bit heightened, or really heightened, because, again, when you're dealing with mental illness, then, like, when you're really in the thick of it, like, everything is just off. Like, again, speaking as someone who suffers from depression, like, suddenly, like, when I'm really in it, it's like everyone's mad at me. You know, regardless of what they say, everything just feels like they're mad at me. And that they can't really stand me anymore. And so with this, sometimes it's like, oh, but these people over here are very nice. But they're nice in a way where it's like, oh, I'll never be that. I'll never be happy like they are. And so it's got a great cast. It's got Nathan Lane in, like, one of my favorite performances. Amy Ryan, who's always great.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of some fun cameos, like Bill Hader and... Parker Posey and Patti LuPone, and yeah, it's just, so it's a great cast, and they all do exactly what they need to do. I don't think I would ever see this as, like, a character-based movie, except, of course, it is, like, the character-based movie, but it's not like an acting showcase, except it kind of is. But it's it goes to, like, what you and I talked about years ago with American Hustle with, like, Bradley Cooper, is that the performances, while great, and while the actors are allowed to be really big and over the top, they're just one more part of this larger thing, this larger tapestry of anxiety and guilt and mental illness, and just such a desire to, like, be free of all of that, but feeling like you never can be, and just feeling like people are accusing you all the time of stuff that, like, can possibly be your responsibility. And so, like, yeah, it's not an easy movie to watch. And I could see people hating it because, well, first off, anybody that went in expecting just another Ari Aster horror movie would be very disappointed. And yet it is kind of a horror movie, just not a traditional one. And it just captures a very awkward and unpleasant and scary element of living, which is your perception of things and how much that colors the world itself. And then what do you do about it? And what if you can't do anything about it? And so it is very sad at times. It's often very funny as well. And it's just such a... I mean, I really liked Hereditary, and I loved Midsommar, but this is really like a leap forward for Ari Aster. Right. It's the kind of thing where it's like, all right, so he can move beyond horror. Not that there's anything wrong with just being a horror director. I'm sure he would have made some really amazing things, and maybe he'll go back to horror, but like, clearly this is something that like is within him, something that he felt like he had to deal with. Not just, I don't mean like maybe he has anxiety, I don't know if he does or not, but like there's just this story in him that just was going to claw its way out, and he, you know, it's almost 3 hours. I think people could very easily say that the film is self-indulgent, but I don't like to use that term very often, because usually what some people call self-indulgent, I call like a director just willing to go wherever the story takes him, wherever the mood takes him. And it's like, yeah, I'm not going to care about how much money this makes. I'm not even going to care if everyone can relate to it. But someone out there is going to, whether they want to or not. And maybe, just maybe, this portrait of fear and this portrait of sadness and all of that, like, maybe it could bring some comfort to someone, because they see that and they think, oh, wow, I've absolutely been there, and now I don't feel quite so alone. But once again, I don't mean to suggest that's his goal. It's just something that he had inside that had to get out, and he was as true to that as he could be. And it's invigorating and refreshing and horrifying, and yeah, I just, man, it just really got me.
Can't wait. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but looking at my list, I'm reminded that Scott and I did toss out a couple honorable mentions at the end.
Okay.
I think mine, if I remember correctly, were Polite Society and Brooklyn 45.
Okay.
Do you have just a couple you want to throw out?
I would say that Across the Spider-Verse is one of them.
Okay.
I will say, damn, it's long.
Okay.
It's 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Wow.
That is
those only, animators' hands must be tired.
I know. That is only an acceptable length for horror documentaries.
Yeah.
but you know, all of the virtuosic animation of the original, like, just they just expand on it, and it's just, I used the word invigorating earlier, and it is just, at the very least visually, it's invigorating. Okay. It's just so much fun, and you just, it's the kind of thing that when you watch it, you just realize like just how hemmed in so many other animated movies are.
And you got another one? We can't go, honorable mentions. You can't go too deep. Your voice sounds like it's hurting.
Yeah, sorry about that. Much to my surprise, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, you know, I wasn't a big fan of the first one. I really like the second one, but this one I think is really doing some great things. It has one of my absolute favorite action sequences of like the last 20 years. And it's just so well done. It has some of the most genuine emotion in all of the MCU. It has a villain that like I was saying about Mia Goth, like there are some villains in the MCU that you're like, I'm rooting against this person.
Yeah.
This villain is like, I hate this guy, and I want him to be killed terribly. And then in this one, because it's a crowd pleaser, oh, you get what you want. Spoilers. But yeah, and also they're just exploring like just the nature of these characters and the nature of being a superhero, being part of a team, and like who you are as an individual, even in the midst of all of that. It's really like, it's so exciting that, like, Disney is just kind of letting James Gunn just do whatever he wants. And I like that he's really taking advantage of it, because this film really does feel unique within the MCU, and I liked it way more than I thought I would.
All right. Well, you can find, probably you can find reviews of something that we mentioned today at BattleshipRetention.com. I don't remember. Yeah, actually, Scott reviewed Asteroid City, so you could definitely find that. You can find me at Davey Pretension on Twitter, on Blue Sky, Letterboxd, David Bax. Check out my other podcast. It's called The One Where I Met Your Mother. My wife and I watch Friends and How I Met Your Mother. And Tyler, any places you want people to find you?
Not right now, but you can follow me on Twitter at More Lessons. That's the one that I'm using more often these days. And you can read updates about my condition. The respiratory therapist says that, in his opinion, I'm going to be getting off the vent in like a few weeks. I personally think he's being overly optimistic, but you never know.
And you'd have your voice back? Or you'd have... Your voice would sound different.
Eventually, yeah. I would have it back. At first, it would be very weak. Okay. But eventually, I would have it back. Almost completely. It might be a little bit raspier, but it would basically be my voice. So that's very exciting. I'm getting a little bit more movement back. I'm getting more movement in my left shoulder, and then some very small movement in a couple fingers on my right hand. And so it's like, all right, it's going slow, but it's happening, and I'm very excited.
Well, I'm excited to keep doing these episodes with you.
Yeah.
So, thank you, everyone, for listening.
And we'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.